You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Welcome to The Money Show this evening. I'm Bruce Whitfield. The Money Show, of course, is brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. Graham Briggs is our shapeshifter this evening. I mean, he's in an old-fashioned industry. It's the industry of gold mining. And as we know, AngloGold Ashanti shutting down two mines. Two of its mines are aged 40 and 60 years old, come to the end of their life or their working life. And 8,500 people are being directly affected. 8,500 jobs are going to go. What's Graham Briggs thinking about that? That is, he embarks on a new venture called Birrell Mining. And of course, the really interesting strategy that we chatted to him very briefly about recently, I thought we really need more detail from him. And that is signing up the Zama Zamas, people who have mined these stopes illegally for some time and sort of saying, okay, you guys know your way around this these mines. Why don't we employ you on a contract basis? Why don't we, rather than have you outside the tent peeing in, let's get you inside the tent peeing out, so to speak. Forgive the fruity language so early on a Wednesday evening. But yes, so it's co-opting people who ordinarily wouldn't be part of the formal mining system. Clement Maniatella, we'll talk to him about President Cyril Ramaphosa, who's seeming increasingly boisterous, isn't he? He is increasingly boisterous on and campaigning to be leader of the ANC. The big five things we've learned from the Gupta files. Boy, oh boy, I'm getting lost. There is so much information. There's this deluge of information. So we're getting one of the people who is up to her eyeballs in emails to just take us through some of the big issues coming through on those emails. So lots to come on tonight's Money Show. I do hope you'll stay tuned.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
On your number one news and talk station.
And if you can't for any reason, and I forgive you, you don't have to feel too guilty about it, but you can catch up with our podcast. Just go to wherever you get your podcast. Usually you can subscribe on our website. You can download it to your favorite podcast place. You can get it on iTunes. Just make sure that you catch up on all the big stories. Today's fast fact, incidentally, four JSE-listed companies find themselves on a list of the world's 100 biggest what? Four South African listed companies, or four companies listed on the JSE, let me put it that way. Four companies listed on the JSE find themselves on a list of the world's 100 biggest what? That's my question to you this evening. You can SMS on 31702, 31567, or you can tweet me at Bruce Business.
702 The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter. At Bruce Business.
Well, an unusual Money Show top story today, but it's an important one. It affects every single one of us, particularly with the world's biggest economy opting out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. A huge iceberg. It's about three times the size of Mauritius, has broken free in Antarctica. 200-kilometer-long crack in the floating ice shelf called Larsen C broke off in the early hours of this morning. Professor Mark New is director of the African Climate and Development Initiative. Should we be panicking, Professor Mark New?
Not panicking right now, but this might be like a canary in the coal mine, a sign of things to come.
So what exactly has happened here?
Well, these ice sheets or ice shelves are an extension of the on-land ice sheet where imagine a glacier that comes along and reaches the coast and it carries on going out over the coast. And then after a while it starts floating. So it's actually a floating ice shelf that's connected to the land, and then it breaks off. And this is something that happens naturally all the time. It's a bit like having a heavy guy on a diving board, and if he's too heavy, the diving board breaks. So it's the same kind of thing that's happened here, yeah.
So when the heavy guy on the diving board, when that diving board breaks, he causes a great big splash, and then there are ripples that go out. The big difference here and why we shouldn't panic about this is because this is ice, and it's broken off. It's not causing any more displacement at all because it's already done its displacement.
That's correct. It was floating already. I mean, the example everybody gives is ice in a glass of gin or whatever. When the ice melts, the level of your gin doesn't go up or down unless you've been drinking it. And this is the same thing here.
I've never seen that. I've never noticed, frankly, in that particular circumstance. What's likely to happen to this massive iceberg? I mean, it's clearly. I mean, with the issues of the temperatures of the seas rising, with the global temperature rising, how long does this massive piece of ice, as I said, three times bigger than Mauritius, bob about the oceans for?
It could be decayed. It depends where it ends up. So if it gets trapped in and around Antarctica, where it's still relatively cold, it could take a very long time to melt away completely. If it drifts further towards the equator and sort of moves out of the deep southern ocean, it could melt in a matter of, well, less than a decade, but certainly many, many years it'll be around, bumping around, being blown by winds and currents.
Should you guys in Cape Town be harnessing this iceberg and dragging it to Cape Town? I mean, we've had crackpot schemes in the past where people dreamed of getting potable water out of the oceans precisely with this sort of opportunity.
Yeah, you need a pretty big tugboat to pull this one along. So you probably want to go for something a bit smaller if you were going to go this route. But it's around the energy that's involved, and it's actually probably cheaper to just install a desalination plant here in Cape Town than to try and drag a huge iceberg from the Southern Ocean.
I mean, the remaining ice shelf now is the smallest it's ever been, certainly smallest it's ever been recorded. Maps have got to be redrawn to ensure accuracy. I mean, this is how big this is. It's like losing your front tooth almost.
It's actually a chip on your tooth compared to the size of Antarctica. It's big, but compared to the size of the Antarctic ice sheet, it really is just getting a small chip on your tooth. So the real concern is if some of the bigger ice shelves, like the West Antarctic ice shelf, start behaving in a similar way, and that's when you're going to start getting potential big impacts. Because when the ice shelf breaks off, then you'd often get an accelerated flow of ice from the land into the ocean, and that's where that land-based ice that starts melting causes a sea level rise. So that's really the big worry. If all your teeth start crumbling, then we've got a real problem.
Is there a definitive link to global warming? Is there something else perhaps at play here?
Well, we know that we've had periodic surges all through history, even in geological time, in this sort of ice shelf calving. So it's a process that happens all the time. The ice shelf grows, becomes unstable, and then collapses and then grows again. What we think might be happening here is that global warming might just be pushing the conditions so that we're starting to get an acceleration of this breakup sooner than it would have happened naturally. And we do see that a little bit in the temperatures of the ocean water around, particularly the Antarctic Peninsula, which is where this break-off has happened. And what we think is happening there is that the warm water actually is underneath the floating part of the shelf and starts melting it from underneath, and then the bit that's grounded on the seafloor starts moving backwards. So it's almost like you're making the shelf bit even longer, and it becomes unstable in that way. But it's the evidence is really hard to pull together to say definitively that this is all due to global warming. It's likely a contributing factor, but probably would have happened anyway. Maybe global warming has just made it happen faster.
Now, when we look at the U.S. President Donald Trump's decision to pull the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Change Agreement, I mean, he clearly doesn't believe that this has got anything to do with climate change. He's at best a denialist. I mean, are we heading down, dare I say, a slippery slope?
Well, it depends what the rest of the world does. So with the big G20 meeting that happened, when was it, earlier this week and last week, the other 19 nations all sort of stuck by the Paris Climate Accord. So if the US really does put its head in the sand and do absolutely nothing and continues on its kind of business as usual fossil fuel route, then it'll just accelerate warming slightly more than it would have happened anyway by something like about maybe up to a third of a degree. So it just means that some of these impacts, the consequence is that some of these impacts that we're seeing will happen sooner. If the U.S. withdrawing leads to a general collapse of commitment around the world, that's when we're in real trouble. So it's more the knock-on effects of the U.S. rather than what the U.S. itself is doing that we really need to worry about.
Professor Mark Yu, thank you for putting it in English. Director of African Climate and Development Initiative at UCT on the line to us from Cape Town. Now, I'm going to do something slightly different this evening because I need to break with tradition. I asked you today's fast fact question, and I usually give it to you just before Eyewitness News at 6:30, but it's kind of relevant to what we're talking about tonight. So I'm going to bring it forward. A lot of you getting it absolutely right. I asked you in our fast fact, Four JSE-listed companies find themselves on the list of the world's 100 biggest what? And a bunch of you getting it right. Banks, says somebody. No, that's not right. Polluters, the answer is the fast fact, says Lelo and Forslerus. Mark is saying, I'm sure we have the four biggest carbon emitters in our JSE. Sasol would be one. If Eskom was listed, it would be another. Well, that's not one of them. Sasol certainly is on that list, but it's not the biggest South African polluter on this particular list. The top 100 polluters in the world produce something like 70% of the world's greenhouse gases. And that's what they've done since 1988. One company, China Coal, by itself produces 14% of the world's greenhouse gases. The four South African companies, in position number 31, Anglo-American. Then Glencore, then Sasol, then Exxaro. Now, many of these are global companies with global operations. So it's not just what they do in South Africa that matters, but they are listed on the JSE. They all contribute to less than half a percentage point of the total burden of greenhouse gases. But we've got four JSE-listed companies in the top 100 of the world's grubbiest polluters. Let's talk to Alex McNamara, Program Manager of the Environment at National Business Initiative. I mean, do we have a plan as South Africa in the light of ice shelves breaking off, Alex, and as a result of this global warming, the climate changing, as South Africa, to deal with our biggest polluters?
Yes, certainly. I mean, if we look at company responses over the last decade, I mean, companies definitely have a plan. I think they've taken major steps in the last decade, specifically around governance. So they've thought about how do they integrate climate change into their board oversight, into their risk management, and their strategy. They've thought about community action. They've implemented emission reduction activities. And they've also thought about climate change as a broader risk. So I think we definitely have a plan from a business perspective. We know it's a real challenge. We know we have to address it. And we have significant projects and commitments underway ready to address climate change and reduce emissions.
Okay, but when we look at four of our listed companies, and our companies are small by global standards, being amongst the top 100, are we doing enough?
I think we've made significant strides. So in the last decade, as I say, we've made significant strides. I mean, if we look at, for example, companies' transparency on climate change has been great in the last decade, specifically reporting to on their carbon footprint and their carbon emission reduction activities through something called CDP. And we've seen with that, for example, that a good group of South African companies, major large listed companies, have reduced their emissions by about 17 million tons in the last sort of 6 years from a select group of projects. They've had absolute reductions in emissions. So there have been good strides. We've had big strides in terms of energy efficiency, the adoption of low-carbon sort of renewable energy technologies, but it's really about taking that next step. So we have a good foundation. We've really achieved quite a lot in terms of governance, strategy, you know, implementing projects, but it's how do we get that next level, effectively, the next ambitious level as well.
And what is South Africa's stance? What is the state's stance when it comes to the issues of climate change? Where do we fit into the global strategy to fight climate change?
Well, we've been integral in that process. So, I mean, in the lead up to the Paris Agreement, there was the COP17 in Durban in 2011, and that laid out what was known as the Durban Platform, which effectively created the framework or the foundation for the signing of the Paris Agreement. So the Paris Agreement goes all the way back to the Durban Platform in 2011. So that was the one area we played a role. We also played a key role in the negotiations as part of the Africa Group, but essentially also we've committed as a country to achieve what we call as a peak, plateau, and decline. But it's essentially an emission reduction target for the country, which will see our emissions peak by sort of later sort of 2025, plateau for about a decade, and then decline thereafter. So that is the national trajectory. It's where we obviously want to head. And if we look at our national emissions, they're actually more or less in line with that trajectory at the moment as well.
And when we look at the state-owned enterprises in South Africa, certainly many of them are fairly big polluters. We've touched on Eskom as one of them potentially. We're big coal burners. Our move towards nuclear, I personally don't believe, is done with a level of integrity that would give me an assurance that this is all for fighting climate change. But we are sort of making those sorts of noises.
No, definitely. I mean, also we must remember that if you look at like a global sample of sort of climate action by business, specifically for the CDP sort of initiative I spoke about earlier, I mean, 11 companies on the global A list in South Africa. So you spoke about large polluters. But on the other hand, we have some climate leaders in this country, as I said, that have obviously, you know, looked at governance, looked at strategy, really implemented projects as well. So we need to balance our understanding of the pollution risk with the activities that companies are taking. And we are at the forefront of that in many cases. The bigger challenge, as I say, is really achieving much more large-scale change across the business sector, I suppose, as a whole. But I think think if we look at the overall energy system, yes, there are challenges. We also need to recognize that obviously businesses providing goods and services that we all want and all require. We all use metals in our lives. We all use electricity. So it's also about a broad understanding of how the energy system could transition, or how we could think about our consumer demand in a way that obviously achieves a low-carbon future. I also want to just quickly mention, you mentioned about the Paris Agreement and the U.S. pulling out. There's been a very strong reaction, obviously, in favor of keeping in and staying in the climate agreement, specifically spearheaded by something called We Mean Business. But I think the key point there is the alliance of cities and business is at the forefront of climate mitigation. And if we achieve that dual parallel, you know, what happens at the federal level in the US will not be as significant as what cities and companies can do at a local level.
Brilliant. Thank you, Alex McNamara, Program Manager for the Environment at the National Business Initiative. Jane says, will the iceberg be visible from space? Well, it's three times the size of Mauritius. Mauritius is, as far as I can tell, visible from space. So I think it would be three times as visible as Mauritius from space, Jane.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Markets were extraordinary today. We saw a nice jump, 1% gain on the JSE. The currency was about 2% stronger. A couple of issues playing out there. Chris Gilmore is an independent analyst, and he's with us in studio looking at today's market activity. The Trumps are in trouble. That's put the dollar under pressure. With the emerging market flows, which were slowing down dramatically and even reversing, could once again see flows start again, as Janet Yellen is playing down the prospect of further big interest rate hikes in the US, Mr. Gilmore.
Bruce, as you say, I mean, if you go back to November last year when Trump won the election unexpectedly, you know, we all thought that the markets were going to take a big tumble. In fact, they didn't. So the markets have actually been acting contrary to what logic would tell you. Now, as recently as last week, of course, you had the PMI figures around the world, and notably in the US, looking very, very strong indeed. So again, you got this move back into a risk-off situation, going back into developed markets. And as you say, the emerging markets were not looking so good. And then now, it's unbelievable. I mean, how on earth he manages, first of all, to send his daughter into the G20 meeting, and now is Donald Trump Jr. is giving all revelations about the Russian stuff. It's a classic textbook in thing in how not to run a country. It really is
unbelievable. Especially not a big one that is incredibly powerful.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. But then Yellen coming out with all this other stuff today is absolutely fascinating.
But she's playing down the prospect of big interest rate increases. She's saying that she's concerned that inflation is beginning to taper. In other words, they don't have as much inflation in their system as they thought, and therefore maybe one more interest rate increase. And then various over years she's talking about. Yeah. And that's only if they continue to see inflation in the system in the United States. This isn't another two or three interest rate hikes in the next year.
Yeah, so again, it kind of instills a lack of confidence in central banks' ability to read what is actually going on in the real world. Because as recently as a few weeks ago, I mean, back in June, we had that interest rate hike. So, you know, it doesn't instill confidence.
No.
And, you know, we had, I'm trying to think where it was. It wasn't Mark Carney. It was somewhere else today, another central bank, that was saying, you know, we're not necessarily going to start raising interest rates either. So it all kind of feeds on itself.
Which is nice for us sitting here at the southern tip of Africa, where our inflation rate is much better under control, where the rand, which was really looking a bit wobbly beginning of this week, we could very well see a rate cut next week, which is a small 25 basis point cut. But more and more economists are suggesting it's time, and maybe even over.
It's possible. But having said that, you know, as far as inflation is concerned here, it is a different kettle of fish altogether. If food inflation particularly has proved to be very, very sticky on the downside. So, you know, unless and until you're satisfied that inflation really is coming down here to more acceptable levels in that 3-6% target range, and you don't even have to get into the narrative that the public protector was talking about in terms of a dual mandate. So, you know, I don't know that we're necessarily going to get a cut, because the last thing the Reserve Bank needs to do is cut. And then all of a sudden, we get another downgrade and bang,
but
that's it up again.
The big risk is the downgrade risk, which is why what Malusi Gigaba says tomorrow, and I see you wrote about it in Business Day this morning on your regular Wednesday column. You're talking about Malusi Gigaba and he's the pipe dream of 6% growth.
Yeah, you know, we've been hearing about 6% for a long time. I remember Pravin Gordhan in his first term as finance minister said, and I quote, we need 6 to 7% economic growth for the next 20 to 30 years to make any meaningful difference to our chronically high rate of unemployment.
He said we need it, and he was right that we need it.
Absolutely spot on.
But he didn't say we would achieve it.
No.
Maluski Gaba seems to be suggesting that he's got a plan that we can achieve it.
And I really want to see the detail on this. I want to see the fine detail on this, Bruce. Well, not even the fine detail. I want to see the broad detail on it. Because to get to that kind of growth, I mean, it can be done, make no mistake. If you listen to Franz Cronier, for example, he'll show you quite simply and straightforwardly how you can do it. But you have to become like an Asian tiger. And frankly, I think we get bogged down in too much ideology and too much dogma here for that to happen over any kind of reasonable time frame.
And, I mean, you just look at the levels of confidence in the South African economy. Consumer confidence falling very, very sharply. And it's happening across demographics. I mean, for people who would dare suggest that poorer South Africans, unemployed South Africans, people who earn low wages, don't really care what happens in the macroeconomy, and as long as the social grants keep rolling in, as long as above inflation interest rates, pay hikes are happening, are completely wrong as well. Because every single demographic is reflecting a downturn and a dramatic downturn in confidence.
Yeah, you're right. And I think Iraj Abedian put his finger on it some weeks ago. He said, you know, once you start losing confidence, people at the top level, at the middle level, and everywhere you look, they stop spending money. And I think you can trace it back to the end of March when we had this disastrous cabinet reshuffle. And I think since then, you've had this huge drop in confidence. And when people stop spending, you know, you get this complete change in mindset.
I was in Rosebank and just going past the old Sutterfords to look like what it looks like, and it's just this cavern of nothingness. It's depressing as anything, but it's not the only one. A bunch of shops in, say, the Rosebank Mall, for example, have shut down. This is brand new, slick, top-end retail. We're beginning to see pressure being brought to bear in our daily lives.
No, you're right. And that's what I said in the column. I said, look, you know, the consumer is, what, almost 60% of GDP in this country. We know manufacturing in a bit of a dwell. Same goes for mining. But if the consumer really stops spending, then we've got a major, major problem, because restoring confidence quickly is not an easy thing to do.
On that happy thought, Chris Gilmore, thank you very much for coming in. The independent analyst and Business Times columnist. Business Day columnist, I beg your pardon. Chris Gilmore here on The Money Show.
702 The Money Show. Call Bruce on 011-883-0702.
Oh, this is funny. Somebody on the SMS line, referring to Chris Gilmore, our market commentator this evening, saying, for a second there, I thought you were chatting to Ewan McGregor. It was quite uncanny. Turns out Chris Gilmore and Ewan McGregor went to the same school. About 100 years apart, of course, because Ewan McGregor is much older than Chris Gilmore. Tonight's Truth or Bull, it's brought to you by 10X Investments, undoing the myths around your retirement savings so you get more money when it matters most. Visit 10x.co.za for the facts. Here's your Truth or Bull challenge. Performance fees align the interests of fund managers with those of investors. Is that truth or is it bull? Performance fees align the interests of fund managers with those of investors. Is that truth or is it bull? Give us a call right now on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. If you want to play truth or bull this evening, I've got 1,000 rand for you in a 10X unit trust. If you get the correct answer tonight, you give us a call right now to play truth or bull. 1,000 bucks in a 10X unit trust.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
On your number one news and talk station.
I need the seventh caller or thereabouts for tonight's Truth or Bull. The question for 1,000 bucks in a 10X unit trust. Truth or Bull brought to you by 10X Investments, undoing the myths around your retirement savings so you get more money when it matters most. Visit 10x.co.za for the facts. Is this truth or is it bull? Performance fees align the interests of fund managers with those of investors. Koketso in Greenstone. Hello, Koketso.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
Very good. It all depends on the answer you give me as to whether I'm happy or sad.
Bruce, I think it's bull.
You've made me very happy, Koketso, because you're absolutely right. Well done to you. Koketso, getting the call right, you've got a 50-50 chance on playing truth or bull. In South Africa, performance fees are what they call asymmetrical, which means you pay a performance fee when your fund beats a specified benchmark, But you don't get a rebate on your fees or your shortfall reimbursed if your fund falls below a minimum return. So it's heads they win, tails you lose sort of situation. The incentives that fund managers take on more risk in the hope of beating the benchmark, there's no immediate consequence that if that extra risk impacts negatively on your return, there's no impact on them. Remember, when you pay active management, you're already paying higher fees for potential to earn above average returns, and you shouldn't have to pay again when those average returns are higher than expected. You shouldn't have to do it twice. It's like having to pay your surgeon, this is what I'm told now, it's like having to pay your surgeon extra because the operation was a success. Oh, you lived. Excellent. That's going to cost you an extra 50,000 rand, says your doctor. If you died, I wouldn't have charged you any extra. Just the basic fee. That's the point that the guys at TenX are trying to make. Now, you won 1,000 rand. Well done, Coquetso in Greenstone. 1,000 rand in a 10X unit trust. Find out what less than 1% in fees means to your retirement at 10x.co.za. Join us at the same time tomorrow for another opportunity to win 1,000 rand in a 10X unit trust.
The Money Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. By way of introduction for our next story, a chief executive of a mining company, not Graham Briggs. It wasn't him. He's our shapeshifter this evening, by the way. I'm looking forward to chatting to him later on. But a chief executive of a gold mining company once said to me, there was only one thing of which he could be absolutely certain during his tenure as chief executive of this company. And that was every single day, at least one person would lie to him. And that's the nature of the corporate world. People cover their backs all the time. They cover each other's backs. The politics is awful, and it's a really poisonous place sometimes to be, particularly if the culture is unhealthy. So I find it really interesting that the chief executive of SAP in Africa could be so absolutely certain yesterday that there'd be no dodgy dealings by SAP in South Africa, so much so that he was threatening to take legal action against anybody who dared breathe the words corruption and SAP in the same sentence. He seems to have gone a bit quieter, declined our invitation to come onto the radio last night. What should companies do if they're fingered in and are accused? And in so many cases, it might be unfair. But in the case, this particular case, Amabungani and Richard Poplack from Daily Maverick was tweeting yesterday saying that SAP, you've got to be careful because they've got the emails, they've got the paper trail, they've got the evidence which led them to publish their story yesterday. So what should companies do when they're accused, even if they think it's terribly unfair, of doing something as vulgar as paying bribes to the Guptas? Duncan McLeod is the founder and editor of Tech Central, and you've got quite an elegant solution here, Mr. McLeod.
Hello, Bruce. Yeah, thank you. I was just thinking about it yesterday, particularly after Brett Parker issued that very strongly worded denial and threatening to potentially or hinting that he might take legal action if anyone suggesting that SAP has been involved in bribery. You know, MTN had an issue. They still have an issue, but they had a major problem back in, I think it was 2012, it initially started, went back further than that, Bruce. But Turkcell, the rival for the license in Iran that MTN eventually won, made some very serious accusations against MTN, accusing them of paying bribes to secure that license in Iran, which has turned out to be a very lucrative operation for MTN. Now, what MTN did was they appointed an independent committee headed up by a gentleman by the name of Leonard Hoffman. He's a former judge, British jurist, very well respected. And this committee, which became known as the Hoffman Committee, put together a report of many hundreds of pages. That he and his team on this committee interviewed were given access to all the MTN executives they wanted to speak to, as well as unfettered access to all the documentation. And in his report, he said that he was given full scope and access to all the documents that his team needed to conduct a full investigation. And the outcome of that investigation, I think it's available on the MTN website to this day, is that they found that the claims made by Turkcell were spurious. Now, that case is still ongoing, and it's now actually going to be heard by the High Court here in Johannesburg. But that Hoffman Committee report, I think, will be entered into evidence during that trial and will form a key part of that discussion or that case. But I think what's important here is that MTN was able, through this report that it commissioned to perhaps clear its name to some extent. You know, in the court of public opinion, I think many people initially saw those headlines and thought, yeah, the big bad MTN has gone and bribed people in Iran. And I think the fact that they got this independent report by this top jurist to look into helps clear their name in the public opinion,
And at the speed with which information moves nowadays, your first response is the most important response because that's the only one people actually ever remember. And you've got to be very careful about that response. Every company needs to have a damage control policy or damage control strategy. Well, if we're ever accused of being dodgy, this is how we respond. And no chief executive, I don't care how connected they are and how good they are in an organization that runs businesses across a continent or across a country that employs 100 people or more, is going to know the inner workings of every single one's mind. You could have a dodgy executive who's terribly good at hiding away corporate malfeasance, and he acting on behalf of the company drags the company's name through the mud. You don't know, as the boss, whether you can trust every single one of your people 100% of the time.
Indeed, and if you're so certain of your corporate processes and you believe that nothing wrong has been done, then there's nothing wrong. You've got nothing to hide. So have an independent committee or an auditor look into what's happened and look into the allegations and then produce a report and make that available to the public. It'll help clear your name. I'm actually a little bit surprised that SAP has said nothing since yesterday when they issued that holding statement. There's been no further communication from the company today. I had expected them to put out a further statement today to clarify some of the issues, but they said nothing at all. I would imagine that there's a lot of discussion going on between Johannesburg and Germany at the moment over what's been said. So hopefully we will get some further communication from SAP in the coming days. But the silence at the moment is a bit troubling, I must say.
You've got to be prepared to live with the consequences. I mean, when Tokyo Sakwari asked advocate Bud Lender to investigate Trillion, and Trillion didn't feel like being investigated, and Bud Lender came out with his pronouncement saying, this whole place stinks. I summarize, you've got to be prepared to live with the outcome of that, of that investigation too. I mean, this isn't an easy call to make, but it's a lot better than obfuscating and making claims that you don't necessarily know for an absolute fact are going to stand up the full test of time.
Indeed, and the less you say, I mean, if you try and sweep it under the carpet and pretend it didn't happen, then I think people will reach certain judgments, even if those judgments are not fair.
Duncan McLeod, founder and editor of Tech Central, a highly experienced journalist who understands the world of information and understands how companies need to respond in times of crisis. SAP may have jumped the gun a little bit yesterday, regardless of whether anybody within the organization is guilty or innocent. You've got to box smart when you're in a corner.
The Money Show on 702.
Your number one news and talk station.
Well, Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa is boxing and boxing hard. He was at the SACP Congress today trying to rescue the alliance with the ANC. Clement Manyatela is in Boksburg at that Congress. Cyril Ramaphosa seemed to be in full flight today, Clement. What was your reading of not what he said necessarily, but how he was saying it?
Look, Bruce, I think also one thing we must also remember is that the SACP is a comfortable space for the Deputy President. He's been speaking a lot on state capture and corruption at the platforms that were created by the SACP. So he seemed very emboldened. He was very happy. He was very firm. He actually went off the script many times, especially when he spoke about Bell Pottinger and criticizing that PR firm for creating divisions in the country, but also raising his concern around some people within the ANC that have believed what that firm was feeding them, saying, in fact, describing them as gullible and saying that they are a shame. So he looked very excited, very energetic, and very firm on the issue of state capture like we've seen him before.
He says they must know they won't be protected. Who are they?
He knows, obviously, of the people that have been implicated in the so-called Gupta leaks. We know that President Jacob Zuma's family, particularly his son, Duduzani Zuma, has somehow been central to some of the emails and the allegations that have been coming up about state capture and the influence of the Gupta family on the state. Also, some ministers and some NEC members that have been implicated, like Museveni Dzwani, Des Van Rooyen, for example. So the deputy president seemed to be sending a message to those that are implicated that the ANC is not going to protect them. And if anything, in fact, he says the ANC mustn't even allow some leaders of the ANC to defend the Gupta family using ANC structures. And he says all of those that have been implicated must face the law, and they must know that the party is not coming close to protecting them.
How was he received by the delegates to the SACP Congress? And those delegates are very grumpy about their relationship with the ANC and how that has undermined the integrity of their own organization.
So the SACP has always been clear on the state of the alliance. They are definitely not happy with the African National Congress, especially under the leadership of President Jacob Zuma. They've called on him to step down. But they seem to be happy with Cyril Ramaphosa. And in fact, it was quite an awkward moment where the deputy president was seen as somehow throwing shade to the deputy president, to President Jacob Zuma, because when SACP invited the ANC to this conference, they made it very clear that President Jacob Zuma is not allowed. They want the deputy president to be the one that's deployed to give a message of support. And the deputy president today was saying, we were happy when we received this invitation and we feel welcomed. And that was seen as somehow throwing shade on the president. But he was well received by the SACP delegates. I mean, he speaks about the themes that SACP leaders really speak strongly and boldly about, the issue of state capture, the issue of corruption. But I think when he started speaking about the need for the SACP to reconsider their discussions and possible decision to leave the alliance and contest elections, that's when you could hear some mumblings coming from some of the delegates, because many of the delegates there seem to be taking a position that this conference must come up with a resolution on whether it must leave the ANC-led alliance and contest elections. But the deputy president seemed to be cautioning them, and I think it was that point that the delegates were not really receiving well.
Clement Magnatella, thank you. Eyewitness News journalist at the SACP Congress in Boksburg today. Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual. Get great financial advice. Old Mutual is a licensed financial services provider. Good evening and welcome to the Money Show this evening. Tripartite alliance is a joke. What kind of alliance without a social compact, asks Maisha. I think the alliance is under pressure. Cyril Ramaphosa is looking at the future of the ANC in power without the SACP and has gone on a damage control exercise and telling the Congress today at the SACP exactly what they need to hear. He's playing with matches, though, within the ANC when it comes to getting firm on his cabinet colleagues. It's going to be interesting to see how the next couple of months pan out. Colin Cullis standing by with Business Unusual, the big five things we've learned in the last 10 days from the Gupta emails, and, of course, our shapeshifter gold miner, Graham Briggs.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
On your number one news and talk station.
Coming up on your next Money Show.
Quiet, please.
Lessons from Wimbledon. Got personal finance expert Warren Ingram to talk about Wimbledon, but he doesn't know much about tennis. So it's the personal finance lessons and investment strategies that you can learn from tennis. New balls, please.
The Money Show. Business Unusual.
That wasn't bad. That wasn't bad. This Business Unusual brought to you by FNB, introducing the innovative 48-hour cash accelerator investment account. It's more than just banking to FNB. That's why they help. Four balls. No, that's golf and tennis mixed up all together. Colin Cullis.
Yes.
Capping salaries. You're trying to get into trouble with the boss, are you?
That would do it. And for the couple of posts I put in the lead up to us wanting to do this, most people would just write it off as ridiculous. And truthfully, it has been attempted many times. And ridiculous, never going to happen, get out of here, is usually the way people do react to it. And so really nowhere has a maximum wage been really implemented. They've looked at ratios and other such methods, but nobody has said you're not allowed to earn more than this, unless it was a completely crazy dictatorial sort of place, and nobody really wants to live in one of those either. But I must say that the issue that I'm going to try and unpack here, for it is unusual, is also very complex. And looking at the various numbers and statistics available, you can make a variety of cases, good, bad, and indifferent. So I'm not looking to try and say definitively what needs to be done. I'm hoping I can simply illustrate what it currently is. And then, you know, much brighter people than me will hopefully weigh in and start exploring further how we can address this. So that's the objective. And looking at just ratios, and the US has been tracking this for a while, their first attempt at actually setting something was back in the 50s. Back then, the CEO ratio to the lowest paid workers in a company was about 20-1. Something that you wouldn't feel very comfortable with, but you could kind of understand perhaps these are people doing new industries and expanding things. Back in the 80s, it had moved to 120-1. And by 2013, it was over 200 times to 1, with the most crazy version I saw was in 2015, JCPenney's CEO was earning 1,975 times more than the lowest paid worker in his organization. He's no longer with them, but it kind of illustrates the point that this is just no longer the way that it can continue. It's not sustainable. And for a group in the UK, they try to find a better way to try and illustrate this. So they said, let's look at the CEO's salary and calculate how many days in the year he would have to, or she, would have to work before they would earn the same as, in this case, the median for an average UK worker. So the median is, you know, half the salaries are above, half the salaries are below. And you kind of imagine, well, a couple of months, half the year, you know, what it might be. And it turns out it was the 5th of January.
5th of January, 5 days. And that, does that include the public holiday on the 1st?
It assumes they start work on the 4th.
So it's 2 days.
Yeah.
Oh, my word.
And that is kind of, you know, that kind of puts it in context. So I went to go and have a look. Well, what is the situation here for South Africa? And again, finding all of the numbers and fitting them together isn't always easy. So you take the bulk of CEOs in South Africa, the average salaries from the sort of the right across the board, and it's about a month, and you will have an average South African CEO earning what his average worker in South Africa would have earned. But then there's the horrible stat that you see, of course, when you take an average salary, you take all those with very high salaries and those with very low salaries and divide it by the total number. So you don't really get a true reflection. And in South Africa, 60% of South African employed people are on less than 5,000 rand a month. When you do that calculation with the average CEO, it's now less than a week. And so I went the whole hog and I said, what is the top CEOs, JSE CEO's total remuneration package against what somebody who is in the 60% of South African earners, in which case they would have exceeded their total annual salary before lunchtime on their first day back at the office. So I think it's something we should be addressing.
It's something we should be addressing. And then the argument that's going to be thrown straight back at you by the consultants who go to boards and say, this is how much you should pay yourselves and each other. They will say, well, if you do that in this very high tax environment, you know, these guys have to pay 45% tax rates. It's good for the fiscus, firstly. And the second thing is, if we don't pay the CEOs, they're just going to take their skills somewhere else. Because, you know, CEOs, South African CEOs, are highly sought after around the world. How would you counter that in that sort of scenario? Because, CEOs in South Africa are pretty well paid for what they do, but many of them could work elsewhere.
Well, the biggest thing I could say is whether the CEOs decide to work here or not, South Africa has to address the issue in one of a variety of ways. And it seems to be that there are three critical factors. And what was kind of impressive, despite me having really painted a very bleak picture of the income disparity, as in the salary in income disparities, that's not where the greatest disparities actually lie. South Africa has made actually some progress in bringing the sort of distribution of that a little closer to parity. And the three factors are the income distribution, the wealth distribution, and then what I see termed as the social safety net. So wealth distribution is the one that really gets a lot of people sort of worked up, because it holds that the top 10% of South Africa's earning population control 90% of the wealth. And that wealth creation isn't just a salary that you get paid, money that you can spend. And I recall you recently chatting about, you know, money making you happy, or how much money you must have to make you happy. This wealth creation is the thing that actually will give you a return over time. It generates an income of itself, or it is something that appreciates in values, you know, shares and property and those sort of things. And that's the kind of thing that actually seems to be the much more difficult one for anyone actually to come up with a real way of managing. And the third element, the social safety net, this is a US series of studies where they were looking and saying, you know, income inequality isn't just bad, you know, for people not getting a fair wage. It actually has an impact on people's actual health. And it's not that crazy to actually work this out, because if you're on minimum wage, as it were, your medical benefits are probably low, where you're living is probably less secure than you'd like. And so there's a lot of other stresses that come from living in an insecure environment. And so increasing a social safety net, something that a state, for example, can intervene with, making people healthier or giving them access to better healthcare, better education, and making their environments more secure with better amenities, you can see how they then could be more productive, and so you sure. could expand it that way. So these aren't sort of like quick and easy wins, which is why I say if anybody has or offers a quick fix, they either don't understand this or they're wrong, because it's just not a simple thing.
It's most certainly not a simple thing. And one of my personal bugbears that I've got with our economic policy, or the shocking lack of economic policy, or the fog around policy, depending on how kind you want to be, is what is happening in the South African economy is in fact making things worse for the poor and better for the super rich. People who've got global assets, and most of the super rich in South Africa, people who've taken businesses out of the country, have taken money out of the country quite legally over the years, if they convert the value of many of their offshore assets back into rands, it makes them even richer as the currency loses value. And so many of our policies are causing the rand to lose value, are losing confidence, and it perpetuates the problem rather than solving the problem. So we've got a policy crisis, we've got a greed crisis, and we've got an underperformance crisis amongst lower income earners. They simply are not capable of breaking through that critical 5,000 rand a month barrier for 60% of people who work in South Africa. It's really quite pitiful, and these are guys who are not making a contribution to the tax take either. So the burden falls, and this is when it comes to the sustainability of your wealth. If you're not going to find a way to solve this problem, your wealth is going to get attacked time and time and time and time again.
Yeah, and thankfully there are some people who are looking to address it, certainly with CEOs' wages. Switzerland in 2013 actually looked to put in a cap of 12 to 1. They voted against it, understandably, I guess. The UK currently has Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, calling for that ratio to be determined and for it to be implemented. I doubt you will get it quite in that way, but the conversations usually lead to something that it improves it. The US, the Dodd-Frank Act was supposed to implement this year the introduction of mandatory, you had to declare what that ratio was. You didn't have to, set it at any amount, but you at least had to declare what it was. And that looks like it's going to be scrapped, because in the rewriting of it with the new government there, it's unlikely to remain in it. However, there is one guy from the UK London School of Business Economics, Alex Edmonds, and he's saying that the issue with these long-term incentive, I forget the full name, long-term incentive schemes for CEOs, they're quite opaque, and they're very kind of difficult for anybody to see exactly that they're meeting the objectives that they require. I.e., they can be gamed by a clever CEO focused on sort of a short-term thing of delivering either a share price increase or a specific delivery or cutting costs, which sometimes doesn't work for the benefit of the long-term sustainability of the companies. And so he suggests something, and I won't go into the details here, but there's a simplicity element, a transparency, and a sustainability element. And for South Africa, it might include something like top CEOs get rewarded with all the fantastic packages that they need, but it should be in shares that they have to hold on to for at least the length of time that they are serving in that position. And those same shares must be part of a package to also compensate workers right throughout the business. That way everybody benefits when a share price goes up, rather than some guy gets a bonus for a performance detail rather than the actual share price.
Absolutely. Colin, we need to wrap up there. But right. I mean, one last point.
More
if
online.
You like.
Well, no, there's a lot more online. I can't say that this is, this is sums it all up or even does it justice, to be fair. But I really was surprised by how significant this is, and it needs to be addressed, and hopefully by some very clever people.
Getsa Gordon, most famous for storming out of the PPC boardroom, ending up with a big fight at the board, then asking for his job back. We know the story, and that caused all kinds of consternation. The one thing he did the moment he arrived at PPC, though, which would seem from the outside to be incredibly smart, was that he tried to reduce the pay gap. He trimmed executive salaries and said to the executives, you want to work in this business, this is what you can expect to be paid. And he used that money to bolster the salaries of lower income earners. It made him very popular with the rank and file, but less popular with his own executives, who said, hold on a second, but surely we're worth more than this. We can work elsewhere. And it's very difficult for one company to do this in isolation. I think he lost a couple of executives at that particular time. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual this evening.
The Money Show.
The Big Five.
The Big Five, brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, your legal specialist for success for the last century. Keeping you close for 100 years, visit worksmans.com. Word of the day by the QI elves today is charrette. They're an intense period of activity immediately before a deadline. Now, I think that the Amabungani journalists have been having lots of charrettes recently, lots of periods of intense activity just before deadline, because they're wading through reams of emails, so much information, so much data that I can't even begin to comprehend it. Susan Comrie is investigator at Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism on the line to us from Joburg. And Susan, we've asked you just to come up with the top five things that we've learned in the last 10 days from the Gupta emails, because there's so much, this deluge of information. I don't know how you guys are keeping track. But I suppose we started off with the dairy farm, with KPMG and the wedding expenses. That's got to be one of the biggest revelations, if we can categorize them, in the last 10 days or so.
Absolutely. I mean, you'll remember if we go back to when those stories first came out about the Astina dairy farm, the Guptas denied, they flat out denied that they had anything to do with the project. We know from the leaks that that was a complete lie, that they were deeply involved with that. Now, what you've seen with those with that project was you had around 114 million rand was promised on the project. A hell of a lot more was given. Around 210 million rand was eventually given. Of that money, we know of around 84 million that was diverted to Dubai. Now, only a tiny fraction of that, from what we can see, was used to actually buy dairy equipment for the farm. The rest of it went through this incredibly complex money laundering scheme, being washed through various Gupta companies before ending up back in South Africa. Now, some of it ended up with certain Gupta companies, from what we can tell, but at least 30 million rand made its way back and was used to pay for this lavish Sun City wedding. And I mean, when you look at some of the expenses that that were forked out for that wedding, I mean, 2.3 million rand for scarves, 250,000 rand for fireworks. Meanwhile, back on the farm at Astina, you've got malnourished cows that were dying, being thrown into ditches. And this was essentially a project that was meant to benefit developing farmers in the Free State.
I mean, the shock after shock keeps building. And then we look at private sector involvement, of course, with the Guptas, or maybe formal sector, business sector. And suddenly the names of McKinsey and a business that few people had heard of a year ago called Trillion suddenly coming into the spotlight. And those connections have cost somebody, at least on a temporary basis, his job.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as we saw with Astina, we had the likes of KPMG being dragged in. Now we've seen McKinsey coming into this as well. So what this deals with is a very lucrative consulting and management agreement, roughly, you know, over a billion rand for Eskom. And you had McKinsey coming in, getting this contract, and then agreeing to subcontract a massive portion of that to Trillion, which is a company majority owned by Salim Essa, a very close business partner of the Guptas. And what we've kind of seen, this didn't come out of the leaks per se, but it came out of Advocate Jeff Budlander's report, which shows the way in which effectively Trillion was there, in McKinsey's own words, to collect their 30% and not do very much work in their view. Obviously, the shocking thing that we had here is we had Eskom and we had Lynn Brown standing up in Parliament and saying, denying the Trillion had been paid a cent by Eskom. We now know from Budlander's report that's not true. They got at least 266 million rand, and that's possibly going up to closer to 500 million rand.
I was talking, of course, earlier on about the issues around SAP and their very, very angry and very speedy denials of doing anything wrong in connection with Sahara Computers, of course, and alleged bribes paid there. And you guys are sticking to your guns and the allegations against SAP.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, SAP has to come out and say that. They're a company that does a lot of business all over the world. They're also listed on the New York Stock Exchange, which makes them, you know, subject to very serious sanctions, possibly, if they're caught out doing this kind of thing. So I understand that they're coming out and denying it, but at the same time, we're absolutely sure of our facts on this one. You have a tiny company which is controlled by the Guptas, which specializes in selling 3D printers. Now, they get cut in at the last minute on a very lucrative deal for Transnet. And effectively, their role is they sign a contract, and the contract is in black and white. We've put up a copy on our website where they say, where SAP promises them, we'll give you 10% of the value of the contract if you are the effective cause of Transnet signing the deal with us. So effectively, they come in at the last minute, and they get 10 million rand out of that deal. Now, not only that, they get we've calculated around 100 million rand over the course of 2016 from SAP, from this massive multinational German software company. And they're paying it to this tiny company, which seemingly has no experience in dealing with those products. And then, and the other thing, of course, that we see is the money then very quickly flows to other companies within the Gupta empire.
Yeah, I mean, chasing the money is what has been so interesting about this. But also the vulgar human element to the story. And I mean, when it's all about big money and it's all about big companies, people don't think that it does any harm on an individual basis. But it does, and we know that. But suddenly when the sexual harassment allegations came out, suddenly the vulgarity of the allegations took on a whole new twist.
Absolutely. I mean, that's not something that we expected to find in the leaks. You know, we have been, as you say, we've been chasing the money, but this was something that that one of my colleagues managed to dig out of the leaks and to piece together a really quite shocking story about different female employees who had worked for the Gupta brothers directly and who were making, you know, some quite serious allegations of sexual harassment and intimidation by at least two of those brothers. There's also an allegation that the brothers had then simply paid money in order to make the problems go away. So that does add another dimension to the story that we're looking at.
And then, of course, the charming individuals of Bell Pottinger, who issued their apology on Friday last week and haven't been seen since, desperately doing damage control. Their business in the UK must be under threat. Their global business must be under threat as fewer and fewer credible entities do business with them, as their own public relations association in the UK is investigating whether or not they behaved ethically, whether they broke any laws in terms of the UK Bribery Act and all sorts of other issues too. We learn a lot more about the dark side.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as a lot of people have pointed out, you know, Bell Pottinger are doing what they would advise any of their clients to do. They're instituting an independent investigation. They are, you know, they have suspended three people. There's one person has been dismissed already. And I think they're trying to limit the damage. But I mean, at the end of the day, this is a company who, you know, they have specialized. They've spent their careers working for some rather questionable characters. That they happen to get caught out this time, well, we have to decide whether or not we really take their apology seriously.
Thank you for pulling it all together for us, Susan Comrie, this evening, investigator at Amabungani Center for Investigative Journalism. I've got no doubt by this time next week there would have been another 20 revelations that'll leave us with our jaws on the floor. Extraordinary revelations coming through from Amabungani.